If you look at the information and the data sources and the inspiration that informs design, it almost always removes the designer from the source part of the equation and instead repurposes them as an intermediary and an interpreter between information and creative solution.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 23. Today, I got to talk to fellow UX podcaster and designer Austin Knight. Austin is such a knowledgeable guy who is doing some incredible work. He's got such a keen sense of business, technology, and user-centered design, and manages to maintain such a humility and generosity in his work. I can't wait for you to hear this powerful interview with Austin Knight. Austin Knight is a senior UX designer at HubSpot, where his work impacts more than 8 million visitors per month. He's an international speaker and author. He's a fellow podcaster co-hosting the UX and Growth podcast. He serves as a UX and IXD mentor at Columbia University and General Assembly. He also has a popular UX design blog and newsletter at austinknight.com. And a fun fact about Austin, he's terrified of flying, even though he flew 150,000 miles last year and has willingly jumped out of three planes skydiving. He has yet to overcome that fear. How is that possible, Austin?
I do not know. I think that a lot of it relates to not necessarily to the statistics behind it, because apparently the drive to the airport is more dangerous, yeah. But rather I just think about how terrifying it would be to fall out of the sky and and like be sitting there in the plane for like 2 minutes, like, wow, I'm like totally about to die.
This sucks.
Yeah. So it's completely illogical, but what I do now, I found the best way to do it is if you just find a way to always sit next to an elderly lady and then you tell her before you take off that you're afraid of flying, you're going to be good for the whole flight. They'll talk to you the whole way.
Love it. Now that's great empathy right there, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So welcome, Austin. I'm super excited to have you on User Defenders today.
I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So as you know, we take a fun superhero approach. It's kind of a unique differentiator. And plus, I'm a big nerd. So I love comics and I love these movies that are coming out and stuff. So, but as you know, every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. And I'd like to talk about yours, Austin. Let's start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Cool. So I'm from Kentucky, which is, for anybody that is not familiar with Kentucky, that is the middle of the United States.
Uh-huh. And
not a whole lot goes on there. It's not exactly a tech hub of the United States, but I grew up there. It's a wonderful place in a lot of ways. And I was always into creative things, and especially the web when I was young. My dad, he's a mechanical engineer, but he had his own business where he was working remote from home from when I was a very young age. He was like one of the original people to start doing that.
Wow.
Sort
God
of
bless
before
him.
It was cool. And so we always had a good internet connection and a good, relatively good machine in the house. So I played around with that a lot, and I did the classic thing where, you know, I realized one day, like, wow, I can actually build something that other people can access. And I also realized that in order to build something, I could steal things that other people had built. So I would go to, you know, other websites and do the whole view source thing, which I know other people on your show have mentioned that.
Oh, yes.
Seems like a common pattern. And so I sort of reverse engineered websites and taught myself how to build them that way. I think I built my first site like completely on my own when I was 10 or 11 years old. So I was lucky enough to get a bit of an early start with that. And of course that incorporated, you know, it was like pre-CSS, as far as I know. So it really, I was able to get in at a ground level. Now it's much more difficult to even, start up with stuff like that. So, you know, really early stuff like that. And then, in high school, I kept doing it and I built some websites for clients and stuff like that. And then I went to college. I was studying psychology, and I was still just as passionate about design and the web and everything like that. So I kept building things, and I started a nonprofit organization. And I did it all myself. I built the website, did the video ads, all the fundraising. I did public speaking and stuff like that. So it gave me a lot of experience in different things, not necessarily in building a business, but sort of like a lightweight version of that. And that led to me getting my first job as an internet marketing director in Kentucky. And then I eventually went to a startup in Cincinnati. And at that point, when I went to that startup, the CEO, he had a lot of experience in marketing and design. He was actually a top executive at Procter & Gamble before he went off to do his own thing. And as I was interviewing, he was like, you know, I know we're interviewing you for like a marketing position right now, but you should really think about design too, because a lot of the stuff I hear you saying, it seems to be more related to UX, like the stuff that you care about. Because in my previous role, I had redesigned our website and it became the top performing site in its category in the nation. I was working at a Ford dealer, so we became the top performing Ford site for a short period of time, but it happened. So I was proud of that. And that was the thing that I loved the most. So I ended up taking a hybrid role at that startup. And then eventually HubSpot, I met some people from HubSpot, which, if you're not familiar with HubSpot, we're a software as a service company based out of Boston, Massachusetts, and we produce marketing and sales software so companies can run all of their marketing and all of their sales through our software. So we're a public company. We're about 1,200 employees. When I joined, we were about 400, so we've more than doubled in size just in the last year and a half, actually.
That's amazing.
But anyway, yeah, it's so cool to see explosive growth like that. But so HubSpot brought me up to Boston, and now I am in an actual tech hub, so I feel a little bit more at home. So that's that. I'm self-taught. When I got my first job, I actually quit college. If I wanted to go back, it would take me like a year or so to complete it, but I haven't necessarily had the need yet. So.
Looks like you're doing okay without it. I think you need to go back, to be honest. But yeah, that's awesome. I love your origin story, Austin, and I love how you got a real early start on this stuff. And it's kind of unique, I think, for you as far as that time goes, that time period. It seems like now it's very common. I mean, kids can learn design and some UX stuff in school in elementary and junior high. They can learn some basic HTML and things like that. So it's very common now, which is wonderful, computers in schools, but I think it's really unique and pretty amazing. And I definitely got to attribute your great pop to that, to inspiring you to want to dive in. I was showing my son some Lynda classes a while back, and they actually did an article on it where he was kind of watching me do some training, and he was curious, and he started learning HTML and things like that. So it's just kind of neat to vicariously sort of see that. And it sounds like that's sort of how you got your start as well. So. But who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
It's a good question. I really think a lot about the people that have influenced me. And I don't know if I could necessarily call out one single person. I tend to, like, when I think about the people that influence me in design and stuff like that or that have fostered my career, it's a pretty long list. But at the same time, I generally don't fixate necessarily on individuals or anything like that, like design celebrity. Mm-hmm. I tend to focus more on, you know, the products that I see, the techniques and the results that are coming out of them, what my specific team is doing. So I think that the people that have influenced me the most are actually the people that are sort of closest to me, like the person that whose team I work on now. He's an absolute maniac. He works out of our Dublin office, and he's influenced me a lot. But at the same time, you know, I also have spurts of work and things like that have been really impressive to me from different designers. Like, I think that Andrew Kim's story for how he got into Microsoft is very intriguing. And if you look at some of his website, minimally.com, some of his case studies are just, the attention to detail is really incredible. So when I look to different work that people produce and different things that people have done, I'm less focused on who they are, you know, and whatever celebrity may be cultivated in that. And I'm more focused on, like, what are, by observing this person, what can I learn from them? So if you really think about the people that have influenced me, it's actually a lot of bits and pieces from all over the place.
I love that. That's a great answer. And you definitely have such a passion for your work. It's very obvious. And you just really keep your eyes on the prize. So I think that's pretty pretty awesome. If you weren't doing this for a living, Austin, what would be your second career choice and why?
If I could do anything, I think I would be an F1 driver, Formula Ooh. One. but I would want to do it.
It's pretty hardcore, man.
It's pretty intense. It's a lot different than what I'm doing now. But I would only want to do it in the period of like 1989 to 2005 when they were running with V10s and V12s.
Okay.
Some really big engines. Now we've kind of, you know, gotten a little bit away from that, and they're using turbocharged V6s, which I'm a little bit of a gearhead. I own a pretty big engine car myself, so that's something that, you know, would have probably always been like during my childhood. I always loved racing, but what I can tell you is that if I were a Formula One driver, I would build my own website, because this is still my number one passion. So
that's awesome. Austin, let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads them to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. Now, certainly, a significant among those is failure. Failure is not something we like to talk about, and certainly we don't put those on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Could you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah, so I think that I've had a lot of micro failures. I haven't necessarily had a moment where I was like hitting rock bottom, or where I built a company that failed or anything like that. I think I'm still a little too. I haven't attempted to build a company, so I can't necessarily speak on that level. I think that the people that do, I try to learn from them, but. In terms of like small failures, that's something that I see every day, whether it be a design that I work on or something that other people at my company are working on. We have a culture that really embraces failure as an opportunity to learn and get better and apply those things in the future. But I didn't always work at companies that thought that way. And so the failures that we experienced, the design failures in particular that I experienced at other companies were much more, I guess, traumatic in a way. And I don't necessarily know if we learned as much from them as we could have. And so when I think of failure, you know, I think that failure is not necessarily creating a design that doesn't hit its KPI or that the client hates or something like that, but rather it's creating a design that doesn't hit its KPI and then not learning why it didn't hit its KPI. So when I was at the startup company out of Cincinnati, I came in and I was effectively the first person to really be in-house running design. And it was an e-commerce company and we had a checkout flow. And the old checkout flow was pretty ugly, outdated. And so naturally, the people at the agency that we were working with, a lot of talented designers, they wanted to update the flow and bring it into the current century. Mm-hmm. So we did that. We applied, it was especially visual, a lot of visual treatment. Basically, imagine, you know, taking something that looked like Windows 95 and then applying a bunch of bootstrap elements to it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did. And it was, of course, starkly different. And if you looked at the funnel yourself, it would be very easy to say, especially as a designer, that the new one was superior. There wasn't really any question about it. the old one was terrible. But nevertheless, I suggested that we test the old one against the new one. So we run a split test, mm-hmm. even though the old one was ugly. You know, just kind of doing your due diligence there. And of course, that didn't necessarily go over well with the designers. They actually kind of took that as a little bit of an insult to the work that they had done and the work that I had done as well, of course. But we did it anyway, and we ran the test, and the new one lost. And that was really puzzling, you know?
Yeah.
We went through a bunch of iterations, and we ended up learning that we were, in a lot of ways, designing for ourselves instead of for our audience. The design team was a bunch of sort of, you know, millennial guys and girls that were either recently out of school or just building their design career. And we had very clear convictions about design, but the audience that we were designing for was, the demographic was actually 45 to 65 year old women. And so the design that worked for them was very different than the design that worked for us. And what we found is that they just didn't identify bootstrap buttons, the sort of flat ghost button, as being a button. They weren't able to actually find the checkout button.
Oh, boy.
And so we needed to add a bevel and a drop shadow to it in order for them to recognize it. So that was a humbling experience. Where, you know, we experienced failure, and it was a huge budget project for the company, and the CEO was obviously upset about the fact that we failed, but we were actually able to recover that and learn a lot about our audience. So it was good in the end.
That is a really, really great story, and there's so much value to take away from that. I think especially where you said, we're not designing for ourselves, we're designing for the end user. We're designing for a specific audience. And I got to tell you, I had a similar story where I designed something that looked so, so much better than the like 1996 design that we had. It was a conversion page. And I was so confident, we were planning to test it all along to split test it, but I was so confident that it was like a no-brainer, it was going to win, but it didn't. Same story as you. It didn't lose by a lot, but it's still lost. And mm-hmm. so that was a very humbling experience. And one thing, this is the harsh reality of this, sometimes ugly wins, or, you know, quote unquote, ugly, uglier wins. And I guess as designers, it's a good branch into your good design is humble, which was a great article and where you touch on a lot of this stuff as well. I'll link to the show notes.
Oh yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's really, really been an interesting road for me, is talking about the differences between design and art, because so many designers feel that their work is an art form, and I just completely disagree. And the main reason why I disagree is because if design is art, then it implies that design itself could be about the designer. It could be coming exclusively from them. It could be self-serving to them. And it's not. Design is not about the designer. It's about the user. It's about the business. It's about solving a problem.
Yeah.
And if you look at the information and the data sources and the inspiration that informs design, it almost always removes the designer from the source part of the equation and instead repurposes them as an intermediary and an interpreter between information and creative solution. So what I have found is actually that the most important quality that a designer can possess is humility, despite the fact that it is at least perceived to be so rare in design. And I think that that's especially an issue with, you know, junior designers. They sort of have this overconfidence, and then you find as designers get older, they experience imposter syndrome, despite the fact that they're getting better. They question themselves more, because the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. I've definitely experienced that. That's been an interesting road, and it's become something that I and my team completely hire against, even. You know, it's a soft, soft skill, soft attribute. But if you don't know how to make a wireframe, if you don't understand the UX process, I can teach you that. But if you have a giant ego, or if you think that only designers are qualified to comment on design and that marketers aren't because they don't have an education in design, or, you know, if you think that because you have 10 years of experience that your design solution is inherently better than the junior designer who only has 2 years of experience, I can't really fix that in you, you know, and you're just, that's not the type of person that is easy to work with. So, go somewhere else.
Well, I think that's great that you actually use that as a filter for hiring. I think that it's something that's overlooked oftentimes, and it's very important. So I love, there's a quote, it's hire for character and attitude and train for skills. I think that's the right philosophy. And also another takeaway from the art versus design. I love Mike Monteiro's quote. He says, "A designer without a client is an artist." This episode is sponsored in part by User Testing, the fastest and most advanced user experience research platform on the market. There's nothing like watching and hearing from people using your product, and that's exactly the insight User Testing gives you. You get valuable feedback on websites, mobile apps, and prototypes from real people in your target audience. Set up your study in minutes and get video, written, and audio feedback in an hour. You can try User Testing for yourself for free by visiting peak.usertesting.com. Peak gives you a free 5-minute test on any website or app. Hey, do you have something? Do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing? I bet you do.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was that time that I ran a user test with a drunk person.
I was hoping you'd mention that.
Yeah, that was fun. We did that as a joke, where HubSpot writes some really, really awesome blog posts where a lot of people know us. The first time that they get to interact with our brand is through our blog. And so It gets a lot of traffic, a lot of publicity, and we're always looking for interesting new stories to write. So we heard about this guy that built a website where you could pay him to get drunk and test your website. And my VP of marketing came to me with it, and she was like, "Austin, this sounds like such a cool idea. I think we should do it, and you should just run this test with him." And I was like, "Are you kidding me? Of course."
Right, yeah. Twist my leg.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's how I met Richard, and he's a really interesting guy. He was actually running the test out of Bali. He's sort of nomadic. Actually, he lives in Boston now. He's working at MIT.
Oh, how about
really
that?
Smart guy.
He's a neighbor now.
We had him get drunk and test HubSpot.com originally as a joke, as like a great viral blog post. And we ended up achieving that. Like we got a really great blog post out of it. Over 100,000 hits within the first couple weeks. Like, it broke a few records for our blog in terms of how fast it caught on. So I was really proud of that. But there was actually more to it, in that we learned a lot from the test as well. There was actually valuable feedback in it in terms of what was going wrong within our site. Like, we actually got legitimate feedback on our site, but also in terms of the proper ways to run a user test and how you solicit honest and direct feedback, because you'll find that when you're running a normal user test, people are actually incentivized to tell you what they think you want to hear and not necessarily what you need to hear. So they're not completely honest about the design that they're looking at. This is just a standard hurdle that researchers have to overcome when they're running user tests. But when Richard was drinking, he didn't really care.
This just sounds funny.
He just tore us apart.
Yeah.
That was really good.
It was great. And I definitely gonna link to it. I think it's Very, it's not only insightful, it's actually really entertaining too, just to see this drunk guy just, who actually, yeah. like you said, drunk people aren't stupid. They still have the same IQ that they have when they went before they started drinking. They're just, their guard's down a lot more and they're a lot more free to kind of say what the first thing that comes to their mind or the frustrations that are occurring. So I'm not advocating drinking, alcoholism, but I am saying that it was incredibly insightful and it was actually really hilarious as well. But you guys, the big takeaway is that you guys got some really valuable feedback. And I think everyone was astonished, right? That you actually would come away with something that would actually, that you would take back to the drawing board and you would actually pretty much immediately redesign this experience and see a huge lift, right?
Yeah. We got measurable results from the feedback that we got. Of course, we ran additional sober user testing against some of the feedback that Richard gave us. A lot of the stuff that he mentioned, we were already seeing in quantitative data that we were collecting. But that's just the what, you know, the quantitative data is just the what. And then with qualitative data, you want to get the why. And that's what user testing gave us. And that's what Richard gave us in a very honest sense. And of course, what you can really boil it down to, the whole thing with that test is just that your website, your product, whatever it may be that you're designing, should be so simple and so well made that even a drunk person could use it. And that's really the principle behind the test. But in reality, you don't have to test with a drunk person in order to get honest and direct feedback. There's a lot of techniques that I mentioned in the article that I wrote, but you can also perform other types of what I call fringe testing, which is basically taking your persona and then extrapolating the two extremes from either side of that persona. If you just say your persona is the median, what is the most extreme on one side? What's the most extreme on the other side? So an example would be you could test with children and you could test with the elderly. You could test with early adopters and then you know, like people that they always have the latest cell phone or they're all over Product Hunt. And then you could test with late adopters, like people that reluctantly just joined Facebook. You can test with people that are limited in different ways, whether it be that you're blindfolding them or you're putting headphones on them and playing music really loud when they have to complete a task and putting them under this certain level of stress. There's a lot of different ways to run fringe tests, and the drunk user test was just one form of that. But even so, with the right approach and the right understanding for user testing, you can really take a process and a research method that is so valuable but also has such a difficult drawbacks, and you can start to get rid of those drawbacks.
That's great. Fringe testing. That's a great takeaway right there. And I got to say, too, I appreciate very much you and the design team, that humility in design in action, because you, even though you love the other design so much, you took this feedback and immediately changed it. So I think that's just I want to make sure I call that out. It's, you know, you're preaching what you practice. Kind of thing,
yeah, so. You have to be that way. The design that we had was really good. It was built by some of the most talented people that I know, people that graduated from Ivy League schools, top honors, amazing designers that have won awards, that some of the people that I respect the most. And it would be very easy to say, you know, this is just one drunk guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Or this is just one set of users. They don't know. They're not designers. They don't know what they're talking about. They're not the experts here, and to dismiss them. But again, if you can approach design with an air of humility and say, hey, what can we actually learn from this? How can we actually improve the design despite the fact that we just got lambasted, in this user test? What is the opportunity that exists in this? And that's what we immediately did. And it worked.
Yeah, I appreciate the slide too, the Batman slapping Robin that you put on the talk. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So
I've gotten to do speeches all around the world actually on this particular experiment. So
yeah, I love it. It's a great talk too. I'm gonna put it in the show notes.
Oh, awesome!
Yep. Yep. So Austin, what's your design superpower? I know you have more than one, but what would you say is your kind of top one?
Yeah, it's hard to choose because I mean, you say that I have more than one. I would say I probably don't necessarily have any. I think I'm always trying to get better and shoot to a higher level. But if there's anything that I do think I'm good at, it's distilling information. And I'm really passionate about it. I work hard at design during the day, and then I go home and I mentor people. I work on putting together speeches to share information with people. I host the UX and Growth podcast where all that we share there is direct actionable information. So it's actually very difficult to put the episodes together because, you know, you take like, it's like the amount of effort that you would put into 10 blog posts packed into 30 minutes. And you know, there's the fear of like, are we going to run out of experience and all of these things? Luckily we haven't yet. And then, of course, when I'm at work, you know, the people that I manage, the people that I lead, they're at different levels and they're learning design. And one of the things that I'm most passionate about is working with them to help teach them how to design, because I've actually found that that's the best way for me to learn how to design, is that through teaching people, you have to really learn your stuff and you have to find a way to condense your thoughts and put them in sort of a very controlled and easy to understand way. And so I think that's what I'm good at. That's what I'm most passionate about, is learning things on my own and then doing my best to distill that information to the design community, but even more so to the people that I work with.
Yeah, that inspires me, man. I really appreciate your heart for even when you're off. When you're off the clock, you're still thinking about how you can serve others in the community, and so that inspires me. And I was reading through your LinkedIn, and one of the reviews you have, there's quite a few there, but one of the reviews, the guy was saying like, Austin is so good at it's not just about catching the fish; it's really about teaching others to fish. So that I thought that was really great. Austin, what's your design kryptonite? Adversely.
If anything, it's a total intolerance for bullshit.
With passion, too. I love that.
Yeah, and this is something that runs in the blood of the people that work at HubSpot. So
yes.
I'm not the only one, and luckily I fit in that regard. But really, people that don't know what they're talking about and acting like they know, or people belittling other people, or introducing bureaucracy, or introducing hierarchy, sort of these age-old things, you know, like who can be at the office the longest, or, you know, caring about where you work from. 50% of the time, I work out of Rio de Janeiro, you know, and I'm actually most productive there in a lot of ways. So I really think that sort of our classic ways that we've been taught of doing business are good in a lot of ways, but they've also introduced a lot of bull or BS to the workplace, and a lot of strong companies that have come out of the tech scene have done a good job of killing that. And the biggest and most important thing that we've done a good job of killing is ego or lack of humility, which goes back to the stuff that I was talking about earlier. But it's refreshing to be able to work with designers, you know, art directors, creative directors that don't have an ego. They don't play politics. It's extremely productive. So if there's anything that I advocate for, it's, you know, calling out BS when you see it,
yeah,
in a tactful way, of course, and then providing a solution to overcome it.
Very eloquently said. I also was thinking about what you said there about ego in the workplace, especially with building products. I don't think any successful product has come from an egocentric environment. I really don't believe that. And I want to take a second to kind of boast a little bit about the HubSpot culture. And I don't work there. You do, obviously. I think you're in the right place because of all the things you've been sharing to that end. But I know that HubSpot takes this so seriously. Seriously, they even have a web page. It's HubSpot.com/culture, where it's such an important thing that they dedicated. There's a whole like page and slide and things like that. Now, as far as me and our listeners, what is the best like What would you say fosters that? What's the secret to success to building a culture that is not based around ego?
Hiring the right people and being very serious and deliberate about it.
Okay.
We were lucky to have very strong leadership that have new ideas, that aren't uptight about things, that they're ready to experiment and try new things. And they wanted to build a company that wasn't just a company, but it was something that enhanced your life as somebody who worked there, and also enhanced the life of the customers that it serves. And so we have, from the start, been very deliberate about our culture. And we put it out there because it's an incredible recruiting tool. But it's also an incredible tool to keep the wrong people away in a certain way. Like, if you feel, and that's, you know, we're a very diverse and inclusive company. It's extremely important to us. So it's not to say that we want to keep away from certain demographics or types of people, but rather people who may not be comfortable in, you know, a workplace that is very demanding in a lot of ways. You know, I work with the smartest people I've ever known, and you can't BS them, because they even if they're not designers, they know a lot about design. They know what they're talking about. If they're not developers, they still know how to write code. So it's incredible in that regard. A lot is expected of you, but then the perks are also amazing. You know, the things that we do as a team to build our culture. You know, we take collective trips. Like, there was recently somebody went through the office and was like, "Hey, I just realized that if we get enough people together, we could charter a plane to Iceland. Who wants to go?" And then, you know, by Friday they had filled the plane. So there's a lot of really, really cool stuff that this company is doing that is so refreshing, and that some other companies are doing a pretty good job of it too. Like, you see companies like Netflix and Google doing similar things. Companies like Buffer and Envision are, you know, smaller, but have similar ethos, and it's provided a really incredible lifestyle. But of course, there are serious expectations as well. So that's kind of why we put the culture code out there. If you go to culturecode.com or hubspot.com/culture, you can see we have a slide deck that's I think it's a little over 100 slides just going through our culture, and it's been viewed somewhere around 2 million times. The coolest thing is that I saw that before I joined the company, and I fell in love with the company. And then I was like, you know what, though?
It worked.
There's no way that's actually going to be real when I get there. Like, there's going to be areas where they don't live up to it, or, you know, maybe they could hoodwink you in certain ways. And that really has not been the case at all. It's lived up to it. My experience at the company has lived up to the culture code in every way. So, I really think, you know, outside of just plugging HubSpot there, I think that if you are a designer that's looking to get into a company, or if you're building a design focused company and you want to attract good talent, focusing on culture as the most important thing in your decision to join a company, or as the most important thing in your process of building your company, is an extremely intelligent decision. And a lot of people don't think of it that way. They think like stock options. They think, you know, what awards have you won? How are you going to fast track me to the top? What's my PTO? At HubSpot, we don't have PTO. We have an unlimited vacation policy. Go on vacation when you want. You don't need to tell your manager. So, you know, everything it's a use good judgment policy, right?
You're an adult policy?
Yeah, exactly. The idea is like, be really serious about hiring people. It's very difficult to get hired here. But then when you do hire people, give them very high autonomy and respect, and let them do their job. Don't try to tell them what to do, and place your trust in them. And that's actually worked out extremely well. Whenever designers ask me about like joining a company, I always say, actually, the first thing that you should pay attention to is culture. And you may find that you don't like HubSpot's culture. So I'm not saying that you should look for a culture like HubSpot's. What you should do is look for a culture that fits where you the way that you want to work and what vision you have for your career.
Well, that's good. So where are people going to be able to send their resumes? Because I know that you're going to probably get a lot, a lot of resumes out there.
Go to HubSpot.com/jobs. We're always hiring. We are very aggressive in that sense. So.
Awesome. Yeah, culture is critical. When you really trust and empower your people, you get great results.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They really say product is to marketing as culture is to hiring and talent. You know, that's something that we talk about a lot. And you're right. Like if you want to hire good people, if you want to retain good people, it's so important to have a good culture.
Oh, so glad you shared that. This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Austin, you know, this is a fun question, and it's, I got to caveat this with, especially the fact that we were just talking about your great team and how you have all built some incredible things together as a team. And I know that you would attribute your success to being a part of great team, working in great cultures. So I know you would admit you didn't get there on your own, but, and this might be hard for you in your humility to answer, but I want to ask you, what would your UX design superhero name be?
I think it would have to be Mentor Man.
Ooh.
Because
I love that.
I try to mentor in every way possible. So what, you know,
that's
all of
awesome.
The things that I mentioned, whether it be leading a team or speaking or doing a podcast, whatever it is.
Oh, that's great. One of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users, Austin?
Yeah. So I don't. I don't, and I don't really believe in doing that. And I can explain why. So the core function of the UX designer is to serve two constituents, the first of which is the user, but the second of which is the business. And when we focus exclusively on serving the user, we all too commonly forget the business. And actually, the most talented designers will be the ones that can propose a single solution, a well-thought-out solution that will solve for both the user and the business. If you're solving for one or the other, you're not really doing your job. And what I've seen is that there is a recent push, very, very strong push, to sort of exclusively solve for the user. And I blame two things for this. First, I blame companies being set up with the wrong ethos. And second, I blame designers for not recognizing what their role is. And I can explain both of those. So,
okay, please.
With the companies being set up wrong, whenever you start a company, you should be focused on your end goal as solving for the customer, not necessarily solving primarily for the shareholders or solving for your own personal interests or whatever it may be, but solving for the customer. And I'm lucky enough to have joined a company that has built that into its values from the start. We're actually, the company, if you really look at it, we're built on UX principles. And what this affords you is an entire culture where everybody's primary goals, like the actual quantitative goals that they have associated with their jobs, are centered around solving for the customer and keeping the customer happy. You know, get a higher NPS score, get higher retention on your software, keep people happy. And if that is the goal of the marketer, if that's the goal of the CFO, if that's the goal of your support reps and your salespeople, then the UX designer is not going to have to focus on stating the case for the user and fighting for the user necessarily as much as they will be able to focus on solving for the user and jiving along with all of those different departments in the organization. So I think that part of the onus is on business leaders to make sure that this whole idea of solving for the customer is core to their business. And then I think that the other part is that designers need to recognize that they're paid by a business, and that they're serving that business, and that in order to best serve that business, they will solve for the users and for the business. And usually, if you have that proper ethos set up, then by solving for the user, you can solve for the business. But if you are exclusively focused on solving for the user and you're not thinking about the business, then you're actually putting yourself at odds with the entire rest of your organization. And that's not productive. So I think that in that regard, designers have to properly communicate to their stakeholders what their role is and how everybody is on the same team. And we're all trying to do the same thing here. Mm-hmm. It's just that designers contribute a certain side of that, just as marketers do and salespeople do. And before a designer joins a company, they should interview the company to make sure that they're going to be entering into an environment that's going to support that work style. Hmm. So I know that that's like a key theme of the show. I think that like defending users, fighting for users, it's really, really a good thing. It's something that we need to do because it's been so overlooked. So I'm not saying to not do that.
Sure.
But what I am saying is don't exclusively focus on the users at the expense of the business and your stakeholders and actually your end outcomes.
Mm. Glad that's recorded. I'll be listening to that back a few times because there's a lot of to really let marinate in that. One of the questions that I would have is, should designers get a BA?
This has been a recent discussion, sort of like, should designers code?
You know? Right.
My answer to all of those questions, first off, is that is completely situational. Mm. It really, like, if you're a designer that wants to go work at GitHub, I think that you should probably code.
Yeah, you know? Nice.
So you know, where are you trying to take your career? I think that's the first thing to ask. But no matter what, designers should have an understanding and a mutual respect for the other functions that are being served in their business. So you, as a designer, you should understand business and business outcomes, and you should respect those. Mm-hmm. And if you can't respect the people that, you know, are trying to pay the bills for the company, then you're doing a complete disservice to your profession. You're making all the rest of us look bad because the people on the other end of that, they're also, I speak at marketing conferences, and they have a lot of gripes with designers just as designers have gripes with them. And I think that as designers, you know, we can be the big people here and we can take on the role to fix that. And the best way to do it is to have an understanding and a respect for what other people are doing within your organization and give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, I mean, it's really easy to point fingers and say, oh, all they care about is profits. They have no soul. Well, you know, where are these people coming from? What are they trying to accomplish? And how can you speak a language that's similar to them so that you can have your job function serve them and they can have their job function serve you? So that's kind of what I think about that, is that at minimum, you know, understand and respect code, understand and respect research, understand and respect business and marketing and sales.
Bam.
Hi, I'm Drew Lepp. I'm the user experience designer and co-founder of Timecat, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
Austin, what does the future of UX look like to you?
Expansion. I think that we are seeing it enter into so many different mediums and technologies. And I mean, there's a really, really well-respected UX agency here in Boston called Fresh Tilled Soil.
Oh, yes.
You can talk to some of the people that work there, and they'll tell you about how they've designed the UX for airports. As in like the, you know, the signs and what is the experience of walking through an airport, or, you know, customer experiences, sort of that entire, collective thing. So I think that there's a lot happening in that realm, but I also see things, like different devices and screens, augmented reality, virtual reality, Internet of Things. These are all buzzwords, but they're happening. And I think that what we're going to see is, you know, web design in a lot of ways was design on the web, but it was not quite as informed and driven by qualitative data and cognitive psychology and all of these things that had be, you know, user-centered, human-centered design, these things that have become core to UX. I think that we're actually realizing that works really good with digital products, but it also works really good in a lot of other ways, a lot of different field sets. And that whole digital product thing is evolving at an accelerating rate. So what I see is an expansion of the roles that UX will be used for, like, you know, the industries and the markets, and also what UX designers are going to be designing on. So I think that adaptability has always been extremely important in tech, but in UX, it's going to become increasingly important. Mm.
Love that answer. Austin, let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I treat my time as currency. And I didn't do that consciously. Like I didn't one day say, oh, okay, now I'm doing, you know, a lot of stuff and I don't have quite as much time. I should start to treat it as currency or anything like that. It just kind of started to happen where I started, you know, it's very flattering as a designer when people ask you to review their product or to get coffee with them or to work on a side project with them or to speak at their event. And then I started realizing that every time people were asking me that, I was weighing it against what other thing I could be doing with that time and which thing would yield a greater outcome. And I've gotten very serious about that. So this applies to a lot of things. I place a high value on time spent with my fiance, time spent in Brazil. I place a high value on building my own personal knowledge, my own personal brand and impact. And I place a high value on building the company that I work for. So when I sit down to watch TV, I don't have cable TV or anything like that. I got rid of it.
Wow. Cut the cord. And
yeah,
good
it feels
for you.
Good.
It's hard.
And if I sit down to watch TV, I already know what I'm going to watch. It's a deliberate action, you know, and I've weighed that against different things. Some could say that's a miserable way to live. It happens to work really well for me, and it's helped me in a lot of ways to optimize how, you know, how I spend my time and realize that everything, you know, everything that you do in a certain way is work, you know, whether you're working on the product that you're building, whether you're working on your own personal skills, you're working on your personal relationships, you're working on your own health and happiness. So, yeah.
Derek Sivers said, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. So it's kind of like it sums up kind of what you just shared, which I think is a really valuable encouragement to all of us to really consider that, because time is the resource that is not replenishable. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
So I actually, for me, the most invincible resource that I have had is people. The people that I work with, the people that I talk to, the people that I meet at events that I speak at or that I attend. So I, you know, even people that I meet online. In fact, I actually got my job at HubSpot through Reddit. I was on Reddit. I was critiquing a website. The person that was building the website happened to be a HubSpot employee. He was like really impressed with my UX critique. He was like, HubSpot's looking for UX designers. You should check it out. I did. They brought me up to Boston. He showed me around. I joined the company, and now I host the UX and Growth podcast with him, and he's a good friend of mine, and I met him through Reddit. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, I think that recognizing, you know, the power of your network and you know, you don't have to be in Silicon Valley or in Boston or New York or Austin or one of these major markets in order to have incredible people around you, or at least access to incredible people online that you can speak with and learn from. So that's been my most valuable asset. I think that outside of that, just having a constant desire to watch and observe what other designers are doing, whether it be, you know, through an article that they wrote or through an interview like the one that I'm giving now or through a speech that they're giving, and learn sort of, you know, having learned through like diffusion from them, is that's been a little bit of a secret weapon for me.
That's awesome. And I want to just say this. I love your show, by the way. I listen and I learn a ton every time. So UX and Growth Podcast is just a great podcast. So Defenders, there's another great one right there. So well, you guys really dive deep into a lot of valuable stuff. So thanks for doing
it. Thank you. And we really love the show. That Matt and Jeff were thrilled to hear that I was coming on it. There's some great podcasts in design right now. This is a good time to be listening to podcasts.
Oh, thank you, man. So if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
How to Lie with Statistics. Hmm. So this is an introductory book on statistics and data. And it goes through, you know, very, very basic principles of statistics that if you were like getting a degree in math or something like that, you would have heard about these things. But a lot of designers, they've never really actually come into contact with this stuff. And I think that it's growing increasingly important for designers to be data literate, which is not to say that they're data driven, where they just blindly follow data, but it's also not to say that they're intuition driven, where they just blindly follow their gut. It's somewhere in between where they can take data and interpret it and make an intelligent decision from there. And a great place to start with that is understanding what data looks like, what you can get from it, and also how it can be manipulated, either by systems or by people. So understanding principles like correlation does not imply causation or random sampling and stuff like this. This is all discussed within the book. What I have found is that it's an important jumping off point for a lot of designers that may not be quantitatively minded. It introduces them to data visualization and all of these different principles that can kind of help them to jump into that world a little bit more.
Well, that sounds like a great read, and I'm definitely going to look into that myself, because I feel like I need to grow to get sharper in those areas myself, just in the analytics and really taking a much closer look at the data behind how people are using your products and things. So I think that'd be a great read, and I'm sure our defenders are definitely going to check that out for sure now.
Cool.
So this is the last question of this segment, but it's one of my favorite ones. Austin, what's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
Great question. And along those lines, a question that I get a lot is how do I get into UX? How do I start a career in UX? How do I change into a career in UX? So for the aspiring UX designer, the person that wants to accelerate their career in UX or get into a career in UX, my advice is to start building things. Start actually designing. If you have to ask about how to get into UX, you're already doing it wrong. No, you're not going to be able to go to somebody like me or to your professor or somebody at a business and say, how do I get into UX, and have them tell you some type of magical word to say that's going to get you into it, because there is no single path into this industry. Education is of course important, but there isn't an education path into this industry. And for a lot of design organizations, they're actually education is going to be factored very low in the hiring process. And what they're going to care about is your experience and what you can actually demonstrably do. So understanding that, the logical conclusion would be that the best thing you can do is to start making something. And it doesn't have to be for a real client. It could be a passion project for you. It could be a fake product. It could be something for a nonprofit organization. You could find a local business that has a terrible website that you want to help them redesign, whatever it may be. Starting to actually build something will demonstrate that you care about this profession more than just asking a lazy question about how to get into it, and that rather you're willing to actually build something and that you're actually passionate about it, and that it's something that you're going to do regardless of whether or not you get a job in the field, because it's what you want to do. And then that's a great thing for hiring managers to go off of. They can look at your work, they can ask you about it, and they can scrutinize it. And without that, there isn't really anything to talk about. So until you build yourself a body of work, it doesn't matter how many certifications you have in Google Analytics or Adobe, it doesn't matter what your education background is. If you haven't actually built something and proven that you can do it, nobody's going to listen to you.
Love it. Just start.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So, Austin, as we close, can you tell us about the one thing you're working on that you're most excited about?
So there's a lot of things that I'm super excited about at HubSpot. In terms of how applicable they would be to the wide audience, I'd probably just sit here and be geeking out for like a minute or two, and then everybody would be like, okay, cool, I learned nothing from that. So what I want to talk about is an augmented reality side project that I've started outside of HubSpot. I don't know what I'm going to build. I don't know what it's going to be, but I have officially decided that virtual reality and augmented reality are actually going to happen this time around. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a mall in Rio de Janeiro, and there was a Samsung Galaxy demonstration, and there was a big-ass line of Brazilians that were ready to buy and to try and buy this virtual reality headset. And I was like, wow, this is how I know that it's actually happening this time, and this is so fascinating. And whenever I see something like that, I can sometimes be really, really skeptical, or like my natural reaction would be, oh, what a pain in the ass. Like, you know, when I first saw Twitter, it was like, Twitter is basically, they just took Facebook statuses and made them shorter and then got rid of everything else. And that's a social network. Like, that's stupid. Or, you know, Snapchat, like, okay, so they took the whole thing where I can send pictures via iMessage and then they made them delete after a certain period of time. Like, what's great about that? And then these became incredible networks. There was a lot of value in it. And so what I learned is that I can't always spot the value before it happens. So what I've tried to do is say, okay, what seems to be something that other people may be finding value in that I may not necessarily see the value in, and just start to do it anyway. Start to use that platform anyway, because I have an irrational, almost, fear of becoming obsolete. I'm 23 years old, but I'm so afraid that one day I'm going to be the guy that didn't learn the new technology or didn't adapt and is unemployable. So, or is at least just annoying to listen to, right? So I like to take on side projects that are new and emerging technologies that even if I personally am not particularly interested in them, or if I think that, you know, they could bring like doom to the world, which is very possible to happen with augmented reality and virtual reality. If you've ever watched Black Mirror, Black Mirror is an excellent show. It's on Netflix, and you should watch the episode called The Entire History of You, and it's all about augmented reality. The whole series is about the ethical and future implications of technology on our lives. So a lot of stuff happening with augmented reality, and even though it's not something that like I personally am thinking is like, whoa, like I can't wait to get my hands on AR, I want to start building with it so that I can learn how to design for it.
Wow.
So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. So the Oculus, the way that Oculus Rift got their branding is after you take that thing off your head, there's this big oval imprinted on your forehead.
I don't even know. Is that serious?
No, I just made that up. No, there's something, there's this picture on Twitter. It was just hilarious. It went around and it was like, oh, this is where they got their logo. After the guy took the thing off his head, it looked exactly like the Oculus O.
That's That's great.
Anyway, yeah, there's mysteries that abound, but that's exciting, man. Really, really cool. So as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Yep. So the best way to find me is to go to austinknight.com, AustinKnight.com. I've got everything there. I'm also on Twitter, @UstinKnight. So instead of adding an A, I just repurposed the @ as the A.
Yeah, I love the creativity there. That's awesome.
So those are the best ways to get in touch with me. If you shoot me an email, if you shoot me a tweet, I reply to every single one of them. So I love to talk about design and hear from people.
Austin, it's been so enriching having this conversation with you. I cannot wait to share this. I know that our defenders are going to glean a ton from everything you shared today. So I just want to thank you so much for being here. And it's been a great pleasure. I just want to say fight on, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. I was blown away at the insights that Austin shared in this interview. I so admire his passion and sheer enthusiasm for what's possible in our work. I mean, the guy catches wind of AR and decides to conduct his own experiment just to learn and even be a part of establishing patterns around this new innovation. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, Defenders. Because I know you fight for the users, I encourage you to subscribe to the bi-weekly Bugle at userdefenders.com/join to find out who the next super guest is and get my usable thoughts. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.